Well, it is good to be here this morning. Katrina mentioned that we don't have a functioning cool headset here, and I think this week it's to your advantage, because if I cough, it'll be a lot easier for me to turn the other way than if I had the headgear on. We've been looking at turning points for the last few weeks. And when Bob asked me some time ago if I would talk about turning points, and at first I was like, no, because I could think of what would I do. How do you extend a story about a turning point across like 20 minutes? You know, how do you stretch that out? I was like, I don't think so. And then I thought, well, maybe I could talk about a few different things. And this week I just kept trying to hone things down. And I thought, for example, about it might have been interesting, some things in my life, like times when I've struggled with sin. Sometimes I get, you know, the Bible says in your anger don't sin, and I get angry and I sin, and I hate it, and it's ugly. And I thought, you know, I could talk about times when I've really prayed about that and just some really amazing things that God did. Or another sin that I struggle with, and I don't think I've got another word for it, is worry. Because God has asked me to cast my cares on Him, and I just challenge anyone in this room or watching on YouTube later to think that you worry more than I do. And when you look at people in the world, right, I have less reason to worry about anything than most people in the world. And what does God think of me when I just keep holding that? So I think, you know, I could talk about those things, and maybe that would be a blessing. But as I looked at some of those things, it's like, you know, there's no question what I should be praying about when there's sin in my life, and there's no question what God wants to do about it, right? And then I also think about, it's not just the bad things, but then sometimes the good things. And there's no question, when we pray here about unity, there's no question what God wants in unity. When we pray about Christians that are being persecuted, there's no question what God would want there. And we know that we're just praying with Him. But as I looked at this more and more this week, I was also reminded of something that Henry Blackaby talked about. In the book Experiencing God, which many of us have read. In fact, as a church, we've read it together. And he talked, for example, about a lot of times you see in the Bible, in the Old Testament particularly, when God did something that people would set up some kind of a monument to remind themselves of the amazing thing that God did. Like when they crossed the Red Sea and it parted and went back together, they put up a monument. It's like, this spot, the impossible happened. And we never want to forget that, right? And so there were it's over and over, he pointed out a bunch of those things, and it was like the nation of Israel at any time could go back to those places and look at that and get the don't you forget. And then, of course, there were ceremonies, you know, whether it's the Passover, a lot of things to help them remember. And Blackaby talked about sometimes there's a lot of different good things that you could do, and so how he knew maybe what the good thing he should do was he would look at what he called spiritual markers in his life. And so I don't know how great it'll be for you, but I just know it'd be a real good thing for me to look back at those spiritual markers and remind myself of those things. And maybe some of this will be an encouragement then to you, and you've probably done it before when if you've read, you know, through the Blackaby's series with us. But one of the things that that's really struck me that I've seen spiritual markers for in my life is this idea of unity. And in the end, I'm going to be talking about instrumental music, and the division in growing up in my heritage in the Churches of Christ, and the division that I've seen over that. And maybe it'll help you to understand why I've done what could seem to be some crazy things. But anyway, I grew up going to, when I was very little, my parents would drop me off for class at a Christian church and pick me up when class was over. And every now and then, Mom would stay for church, and I would listen. The preacher very often started with a joke, and even though I was in elementary school, I would try to hang on until the joke. Right? And I loved it there. But then something happened, and I ended up going to this Church of Christ in the seventh grade. And I remember the first time that I stayed beyond, parents would drop me off for class, pick me up. The first time that I stayed for the assembly, I remember when the church sang, I felt really uncomfortable because there were no instruments. And it was like, there's a mob here. And it was a seventh grader. It doesn't have to make sense. I just felt it was like dangerous, you know. And then, so I was there for a long time, and I ended up at going to college. And I remember the first time I had a friend that invited me to go to a Christian church with her. And we were there, and I still remember when they started singing, it was deja vu. And it was like, this is weird. I'm like at the mercy of a mob here. I'm like, whoa, I felt that way before. This is what I'm used to. And it's not this emotional thing going on in my head. It's just what I'm familiar with. Well, anyway, I had always had a little difficulty with this idea of instrumental music. I was a missionary apprentice after college, went to Chile for a couple of years, and we sang a cappella, but I just couldn't teach on it because I was like, just doesn't make sense to me. And then I came back and, see, here I go kind of coughing and stuff. I became a campus minister at UT Arlington. And just as I started, there was another campus ministry that had just gotten started. It's called the Cornerstone. It's still there. And the Cornerstone is under the direction of the Bible churches. And there was a fellow there named Davey Noggle, and he was doing a bang-up job. I mean, he had gotten a ton of kids involved, and he was working on plans. He wanted to get a building where kids could intern, they could live there, and he just had all these tremendous plans, and things were working. And then all of a sudden it came out that he didn't believe in premillennialism. And the Bible churches believe in premillennialism. And they were pretty much very upset with him. And he said, look, he said, it's not a core issue. I mean, we never talk about this in the campus ministry. In fact, he said, people in the church are coming up and they're saying, Davey, what do you believe? And after he said that, then they said, okay, now what do we believe? He said, you know, this shouldn't be an issue, but they fired him. And I just couldn't believe it. And I had a lot of respect for him. And I went over to speak to Davey and just about that issue. And out of nowhere, I never expected, he blindsided me and he says, and what do you think about instrumental music? And I was just like, this question wasn't supposed to come up. And I said, I have a hard time believing that that's an issue. And he said, Danny, I think you can make a great difference in your fellowship on that issue. And I thought, that's nuts, you know? But there it was, and it wasn't supposed to have happened. As I continued in the campus ministry, one day there was this guy, and I read about him in the newspaper. He was walking across America, and he had this cross on his shoulder. At the bottom of it, he had a wheel to keep the cross from wearing out. He caught grief over that, but he was like, I carry this thing, and he said, it doesn't take long for a wooden cross to whittle to nothing. So he had this wheel, and he came in my ministry. And he said, I'm just here to encourage unity. And I said, Church Christ Line. I'd like for there to be unity, but we, you know, there's some important things that we disagree about. And he said, I'm just here to encourage unity. It was like, give me something I can argue with. But he wouldn't, you know. And then he was gone, and I couldn't let what Davey said leave me. I couldn't let what this guy had said leave me. And then the guy that eventually, over time, replaced Davey, he was a real believer in unity as well. And he was saying, you know, we could maybe make a difference on this campus if we were, instead of a whole bunch of little individual campus ministries doing things, if we just tried to work together and be one. And he says, I know you've probably got some difficulty with this, but I think we could do it without singing. I think we could just not have singing, and it'd be okay. And I thought, we could do that. And so I started working that angle, and I started doing all this kind of stuff, working on it. And about 2 weeks later, he came back in, and he says, you know, I've been thinking about this. I've been praying about it, and I don't think we can do it without singing. And I was like, oh, you pulled the rug out from under me. What am I going to do now? Because I'm already on record. I'm already trying to make all this happen, and you did that. And so I thought, okay. I'm the guy who believes in unity. I'm the guy who doesn't think that this should be an issue anyway. So let me see how this can work. So the North Davis Church of Christ was our number one supporter. So I went and talked to the elders at North Davis, and God is amazing. And they just said, that'll be fine, just don't do it in our building. Okay? The next supporter was Woodland West. And after that, they really trailed off. And so I thought, okay, I need Woodland West on board. And so I had a work-study job on campus my freshman year and still knew a guy who had gone on to become one of the elders at Woodland West. We had worked together. I felt like I knew him. So I asked him if we could have lunch. And so we had lunch, and I told him what I wanted to do. And the first thing out of his mouth was, no, this cannot happen. We will not be behind that. And then I didn't say another word. He just kept talking. And he just kept talking. And the more he talked, the more he turned 180 degrees. And by the time we were done, I promise you, I didn't say anything else. By the time we were done, he said, the Woodland West Church is going to be behind you on this. I will talk to the elders. Don't you worry about it. Consider it done. I was like, whoa, God, was that you or what? It was so amazing. And so we went on and we started doing things together. And I remember one of the first events, I was going out to put up some flyers for it. And as I was leaving our building, it was interesting that God, just at that time, we had a group of students who were in our leadership who were very, very conservative. And several of them actually were going to Brown Trail. We had all of our leaders would be at Richland Hills, and it just kind of fluctuated all over. And the student leader said, I can't believe you're doing this. And I don't remember if he used the word hell in it or not, but he was very upset about what we were doing. And so I'm walking off thinking, God, what have I done? Am I destroying things? Is this good? Is this, I don't know. And I'm hanging up in the very first building, and there's another student who has just gotten involved with us coming down the stairs as I'm going up, and he says, I am so excited about this thing, and I can't wait to be there. I thought, okay, that's pretty quick for an answer, God. You know? And so this student who was so opposed to what we were doing, he came back in later, and he had a booklet that was written by the guy who was preaching at Brown Trail about instrumental music, and I just opened it up, and I had studied these issues, and I just took the first one that was there, and I said, this is wrong, and here's why. And I gave him this list of things. I actually had my notes. Here's a copy. And I just want you to think about it. And he came back a couple weeks later, and I never dreamed that he would have shown this to that preacher. I was like, I'm hoping you and I can talk about this. And he came back in, and he said, I showed your notes to the preacher. And I said, oh, what did he say? And the student responded, he says, I guess I can't use that argument anymore. And I thought, okay, God, maybe people will listen. So anyway, about that time, I was looking at a number of issues. And, you know, if a preacher does something wrong at a congregation, the congregation takes a hit, but the church usually goes on. But I was thinking, here I am in this campus ministry. If I do something that ticks off a bunch of churches, we may not recover, right? And so it was a real struggle for me to, how do I keep encouraging unity? But anyway, at about the same time, as soon as I prayed, we became convinced maybe it was time for us to step out of campus ministry anyway. And so at that point, that it was like, okay, I've got no excuse on this issue. God has been pointing out things to me, all of these spiritual markers, all along. And so I started working on this book. And I honestly tell you, there were a lot of times when I was ready to just completely stop. I would look at it and I would say, this is impossible. I'm never going to convince anybody of anything. God, I don't know why you want me to do this. I don't want to do it. I felt like the, you know, Moses when he said, would you just get someone else? You know, I was there so many times. Once I got things written, I started sending it off to see if I could get a publisher. One publisher said, you know, the political climate would never let me print this, so no. And I had a friend, Milton Jones, who was a preacher in Seattle at the time, but he had been he's a real leader in campus ministry and thinking and that kind of stuff. And so I wrote Milton, and he said, you know, the Christian churches probably won't print yours, because I just printed one of mine on this subject. And I hadn't even known it. And he said, and what happened with that is that that Christian church publisher, after they published my book, Milton speaking, Pepperdine University disinvited them to sell books at their lectureship anymore because they had dared to print one book that disagreed about instrumental music. And he said they might have gotten away with it, except that all the other people that wanted to go to the lectureship went to Pepperdine and said, this ain't happening. If you want to have a lectureship that's like this, we're not coming anymore. And Pepperdine said, you know, I think we'll go ahead and let them come, okay? In fact, what happened is every time I sent off to a publisher and I'd get a rejection letter, and sometimes they would give me an idea of, well, maybe this would help if I did it a little differently this way. And so I think it got better as it went, but sometimes, it was interesting, even a fellow who was head of a Bible department in one of our Christian colleges, I asked him if he would read it, he said yes. And he gave me feedback even. And his main feedback was, be kind. I thought, point taken. Danny Corbett has a problem with anger and not knowing, responding well with it. And this ticks me off sometimes. So I went back and I tried to make that book as kind as I could all the way through it because of what he said. And then people were sharing my book, my manuscript that I didn't even know about. I know Milton told me that Rick Atchley had asked for a copy of it just before he did his thing with Richland Hill saying, we're going to have instrumental music. So I thought that was kind of cool. But also, I had this fella that wrote me, and there was another book on instrumental music printed in, I think it was 1964. So it had been a long time since there was a book that was anything but pro a cappella. And this guy said, I published Tom Burgess's book, Documents on Instrumental Music, and I think your book is fantastic. And so I talked to him, and he said, but, he says, I've told my wife I'm not going to leave her with a stack of paperbacks in the garage that she's going to have to sell when I die. And he said, it would be commercial suicide for anybody to touch your book, so you need to self-publish. And I said, okay. Thank you, God. I don't know how you got a copy of my book, but you did. And thank you for that. And Cindy had a friend whose wife had self-published, and so we were talking to him, and he just pointed out, you know, a lot of people say when you get a publisher, they think, woohoo, score, I've got it done. He said, actually, all you've done is got it printed. There's still the marketing. There's still a... And he says, what you got to do is talk to bloggers. So at that point, I began trying to talk to bloggers, and I got such a mixed bag at first, and then there's this fellow named Jay Gwynn, and Jay was he's passed away, which grieves me, but he was an elder in Alabama, and he had one of the most popular Church of Christ blogs, and out of nowhere, Jay said, this book is fantastic, everybody needs to buy it, everybody needs to read it, and all of a sudden, I was hearing from people everywhere. He quoted excerpts out of it, and so people started looking at it. It was about that time then that I started seeing some things where people were saying, you missed some stuff in history. There were some historical things, I was going back, I was looking, man, I read all these scholars, and they didn't say anything about these things that you're pointing out. How did I miss those? How did you miss those? And as I went to digging, it's like those things that people were pointing out didn't happen. It's just what we've always said, but it wasn't true. In fact, it was. I wrote to Everett Ferguson, one of them, and I said, you said this all started at the end of the 4th century, but here's Clement of Alexandria saying such and such. And he said, yeah, Clement wasn't talking. Clement was talking about a banquet. He was talking about your everyday. I mean, he was just against instruments, period. And I was like, oh, well, that doesn't come across in our stuff. But Everett Ferguson is he's a very kind man, and he's very honest. Very honest. And there were a couple things, actually, that I bounced off of Everett. And both of those things, it was like, well, no reason I didn't find that anywhere else, because we concocted it. And so it was interesting how, for example, then... I had also, right after I published, probably before Jake got a hold of it, I wrote to ACU and said, could I speak at your lectureship? Just crazy, right? And this was like in September, the lectureship's in February, and he says, no, we're already set for this year. Maybe another time. And so I was like, you know, I've planned major events, and I know it takes a long time, so okay. Well, then that lectureship passed, and then he called me for the next lectureship. He called me, and he said, would you like to speak? And I said, yes. He said, you'll never believe what happened. He says, my father-in-law came to me with your book and said, have you seen this? You need to read this book. And we happen to know the backside of this story is Phyllis and her husband David, who give money to our mission trip to go to Bronx, have done so the last couple years. Phyllis lives in this, and David live in this podunk town called Gonzales, and so does Phyllis's dad, right? And Phyllis's dad, Phyllis got my book, Phyllis's dad got my book, Phyllis's dad gave my book to this fellow who lives in Podunk, Gonzales, and says you ought to read it. And that fella was the father-in-law of the head guy who directs ACU. And so I had heard this story from both sides. I'm like, isn't it amazing what God does when he wants to do it? There were some interesting things that happened along the way. I was curious about friendly fire. It seems like some of the people that the friendly fire would come from people who had their PhDs, and they would often say things like, you know, a much better book could have been written. And I thought, right, but you didn't do it. And then I had another, there was a group that they were Christian churches and Churches of Christ kind of together, and I'd asked them right away if they would review my book. And almost immediately they sent me a review of the book. I didn't particularly like it, but they wrote the review, but they didn't publish it. A couple years later, after my book had really gotten traction, they published it. I'm thinking, they're an internet group. There's no ink and paper to pay for, but they didn't want to publish it until they knew that the horse was out of the barn, right? Gospel Advocate, I had talked to Everett right away. Gospel Advocate, after the book had been out a couple years, they asked him to write a review. But the most interesting thing to me was Wineskins magazine. I had asked them if they would write a review, and they initially said, why don't you just give us one of the chapters, and we'll run one of your chapters. And I thought, that's a cool idea. If people can read a chapter and don't like it, you can't get a much better review than that. But then they changed their mind. They said, I think we just don't want to go that way. Well, Jay Gwynn, as I said, had gotten involved in all of this, and let me tell you one more thing. As I'd studied about some of the history, there's a story, for example, of a fellow named Justin Martyr, and we have always said that in the middle of the second century, he spoke out against instrumental music. Well, the truth is, we've known for almost 200 years that he didn't write it. It came a few hundred years later by somebody else, and so I had written that. I used to have this little website, just one page for my book, and I added a page about Justin Martyr. And I just sent it to Jay Gwynn. I said, read this and see what you think about it. And instead of giving me feedback, he just put up in his blog and says, Danny Corbis wrote a really interesting thing about Martyr and do this. So anyway, so Jay had been thinking about unity and actually instrumental music. So here, Wineskins, when I had asked him, had said, we don't think we should touch this. Jay wrote me back and he says, I'm going to be the guest editor for the December quarter of Wineskins magazine, and it's going to be about instrumental music. And I'd like you to write two articles, and this is what I'd like you to write on, and Rick Ashley's writing an article on this, and he just had all the, and it's like, wow, how God just turns things around. And so anyway, as I wrote a couple articles, I did more research, did a couple articles, and a fella said, I remember one fella saying, I was looking at it and saying, if what Danny's saying is true, however he finished the sentence, and I thought, if this is true, that's where people are. They've never heard a challenge to any of these things. So I just continued to look into history, and so I actually finished it up this past week. I hit the publish button on Amazon Thursday for a book on history. You can only get it from Amazon. But I let a few people read it early on. Jeanette gave me some terrific feedback that I incorporated into it. But I found that some people look at it and they say, what are you doing? Does anybody care about this issue? And for me, I look at it and I just say, these are my spiritual markers. And I tried to tell God no, but I just believe that things have kept happening. You know, I honestly, before the first book published, this is just going to sound crazy, but I thought, I am not going to die before this book is finished, because sometimes I thought that would be a nice way out. That I'm not going to die before this book is finished, because this is what God has asked me to do, and he has made it in no uncertain terms to me. And so each day since then has been just without guarantee, just great. So I'd talk to you about some, I don't have time to go so much into other spiritual markers, but I do want to hit one other that's one that I pray that I'm reaching for now. Another thing just has to do with reaching the lost. When I was growing up, we went on summer mission trips. We did a lot of things reaching out to people. And I remember thinking, why am I knocking on strangers' doors when there's people that I go to school with? There's, you know, and I need to reach them. And I remember my folks said, I like your youth group thing, but don't invite them to the house. You know, you're not doing this. I remember when I went to college, I thought, okay, this is my chance. Do I want to reach people, or are my parents just my excuse for not doing it? And I really struggled with exactly how to do that. And a lot of you know Marilyn Stinson. It's a counselor that a lot of us have gone to. Well, Marilyn started her master's degree in social work at UTA the same year that I started my freshman year. And I told Marilyn some of these thoughts. You know, I've wanted to reach out to people, and I don't know how to do it. And a few days later, she comes back and she says, I've got this guy. You're going to invite people to a Bible study in your dorm room. He's going to teach for 3 weeks, and then you're taking over. Like, you know, Marilyn, you know, she's like, you know, here's a problem, here's a solution. And so I talked to my suite mates, and I said, okay, here's the deal. Because they went to the campus ministry with me, too. And I said, this is what we're going to do. And it's interesting. He did a good job. But after the first week, we were all like, we can do this. You know, we know these people. We know our dorm. We know all of these folks better than he does. And we can do this. And so he was there like 3 weeks. And then this was actually my sophomore year when it started. And that Bible study ran the whole time, 3 years till I graduated. We were there. And I remember sometimes people would, who didn't, you know, we did a lot of stuff. We had intramural, we coordinated intramural teams. We did a lot of things so that we'd be together. And we saw a lot of our friends baptized and born again. And it was very, very exciting. Sometimes kids who didn't live in our dorm would come from the campus ministry. And I would think, I don't know, how do I make this something that you could do, that you could relate to? Because you don't live in the dorm. What could... And I was like, I don't know. I don't know how I could do that. And that's a thing that I struggle with each time. In where I am right now, how can I do that? When I went to Chile as a missionary apprentice, I remember they said, don't study the Bible with anyone until you can study with all their family. And I've been working with college students. That was an impossibility. And they pointed out how many times, you know, Cornelius and his household and all these people in their household, and they would get together. And I was blessed to be a part of a group that was very evangelistic. You know, when the campus ministry position came open, Cindy asked me if I wanted to be a campus minister at UTA. And I said, no, I'm not interested, and do not ask me again. Because I didn't want to work again for a church, because it was like, those are the ones who are going to tell me it has to be this way. And she wouldn't shut up. And so I eventually became the campus minister, because I thought, you know, I am at least off in a different place. And I remember working with international students. I know this is... And a student came up and he said, you know, when I was in Portugal, we used Let's Start Talking to help people learn about the Bible. And he says, I'll bet we could do that here. And I said, okay. We're always looking for some other way to do this. We call the Let's Start Talking people down, and they were so cold. They were like, we'll tell you about this mission, but you need to go over to China. You need to go, you know, and they were doing all this kind of stuff. And in fact, one time when I went to order books, they said, you know, we've got some teams going out, and we've got to make sure there's enough books for them. And if there are, then we'll sell you some books. It was just how, you know, bizarre our approach was. And now they look back at it, and they're doing Let's Start Talking in universities all over the nation. But it's just kind of like, again, God working these things out. But anyway, with the internationals, I remember we had students that would want to read the Bible, and sometimes it was tough finding people. I remember one Sunday at North Davis, they gave me the opportunity to speak, and I told Cindy, I said, I may be fired. This may be the last Sunday, but if in a congregation of 1,000 people, if I can't find a couple dozen people that would read the Bible with an international student, then somebody else needs to be in this position. So I just told them, I said, I have students coming in saying, I want to read the Bible with someone, and I have to say, I don't know when I will find someone who can do this. I remember a lady at North Davis called me after I asked her to do it, and she said, do you know how stupid you feel asking God if he wants you to study the Bible with a person who wants to read it? But I also saw in the campus ministry sometimes, I remember one day a student came in and he said, can you help me? I'm lost, and I think I need Jesus. I was sitting in my office. He was out in the lobby with a bunch of students, and I counted like to about 5, and there was a chorus that said, Danny. And I thought, what is it about our kids growing up that we think when someone says, I'm lost and I think I need Jesus, that I need to go get help because I'm going to screw this up. God has brought this person in here, and God is very hopeful that I don't do anything because he won't be able to fix it, right? If I try to help, it's going to screw it up beyond God's ability to repair this. And so I kept working out, why is it? And so, you know, some of the things that we've studied here that have really touched me are these ideas of how can we do a better job of, as ourselves, reaching out to people at our workplace, reaching out to our neighbors. The idea, you know, Sarah went up and she didn't, to the Bronx, and she didn't say, we need another church program. You know, if we can just get people to come to our church. No, instead she says, I'm going to move into the neighborhood. Right? And that's where she's making it. And so really, that's what all of us, everybody's done. We've moved into a neighborhood. We've moved into where we're working. And so I guess that's my greatest prayer, the thing that I want to see God moving in and doing miracles in, because he's got all these spiritual markers of how he wants us to reach, and we've seen it in our lives. And so I just want to keep turning those prayers on for that as well. So anyway, so that's turning points, spiritual markers. It was a good activity for me to go back through, and I'd like to encourage you to think it'd be a good activity for you to look back and see the things that God's been pointing you to as well. Thanks.